All right, welcome to the Salt City Hoops podcast. As always, I'm Spencer Hall, at Salt City Hoops on Twitter. Justin Davies from Jazz Hype is here as well. We've got a very special guest. We have Kirk Craigthorpe from the Salt Lake Tribune, longtime writer. I grew up, I've told him this a lot of times in the press room, that I think I've read every single thing he's written since I was probably about 10 years old.
Wow.
So it's really a privilege to have him on with us tonight. And we'll look forward to hearing some of his things. He's been covering the Jazz since the Frank Layden era, and he'll have some insight on what's going on. If you wouldn't mind, maybe just start us off. You know, Brian T. Smith wrote a really interesting article, his interview that he had with Kevin O'Connor. And I'd like to hear your opinion on Kevin O'Connor's, you know, the job that he's been doing, and where you kind of see, if you've bought into the vision that he's kind of been giving back to the media.
Well, it's kind of hard to totally grasp what he's trying to say and where he wants to go with the whole thing. I find myself more skeptical than usual about the Jazz these days and just what it's going to take to get back to even the level they were at 3 years ago. I look at 2008 as kind of the recent high point of the franchise when they beat Houston in the first round and took the Lakers to six games and almost forced overtime in game six of the second round and just haven't been close to that level since. And now you look at the way the teams like Memphis and New Orleans have come on, and it just seems like the Jazz are farther away than ever in the Western Conference.
Yeah, and I think you bringing up Memphis is a perfect example. They picked up really just loose pieces. It wasn't like they went out and got a Carmelo Anthony or someone else. They picked up loose pieces and really made a huge transformation of their franchise at the trade deadline.
Yeah, it's amazing what they've done. Lionel Hollins obviously has done a great coaching job, and you're right, they've just gradually gotten better, and what they're doing with the Spurs is remarkable. If they can finish that out, obviously it's only the second time that a number eight seed has won a seven-game series, and it's really impressive.
Yeah, it really is. I had the Spurs as my sleeper pick, and it's looking foolish right now, but I did not see Memphis coming on like this. But
yeah, I think a lot of us were that way. When they won the first game, my immediate thought was, well, they had to shoot 55% to do it, and Manu Ginobili did not play in that game for the Spurs, and so you kind of figured that things would straighten themselves out as the series went along, but that certainly hasn't happened.
Yeah. Now, getting back to Kevin O'Connor, you know, in Minnesota, they've had a bad team for a long time, and they've got David Kahn, a former journalist, so, I'm sympathetic towards him, but at the same time, he pitches a vision, and it sounds so ridiculous to those of us on the outside, but clearly people are buying into it. On the other side, Kevin O'Connor doesn't really show his cards, but he kind of expects us to be patient and buy in. And I keep thinking about how rare his situation is, where he's had ownership so loyal, he's had so much influence that really he has no... he doesn't really have any threat. I mean, clearly he was more powerful than Jerry Sloan, which is incredible. So do you think our fans, some fans are starting to feel a little bit jaded. Do you think that's a fair reaction to the way that he's handling the situation?
Yeah, I think you make a great point. It's almost like what would Kevin O'Connor possibly have to do to get himself fired?
Yeah.
it really is hard to imagine the Miller family doing something like that, and you're right, it's not necessarily because of merit. It's almost like a endowed chair in a lot of ways, and so I really am curious to see how patient fans are going to be. I mean, when they made the Deron Williams trade, that's exactly what I wrote, that well, if people are really endorsing this, let's see if they really apply the patience that it takes to sign off on it. And if the Jazz, let's just say, if we're having the same conversation next year and the Jazz haven't made the playoffs, I think people really will be restless.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the thing that was really odd is the way he kind of wanted the fans and the media to be patient as if he was cleaning house on someone else's mess. But, you know, he was the one that brought the guys in. So, you know, I get what he was trying to do with, you know, we're being proactive and we don't want a Carmelo situation. But there's this little sense of the fans are sheep and you're going to come no matter what and we're smarter than you. Do you think that's fair to kind of make a little bit of that kind of takeaway? Maybe that's not what was meant, but that's kind of the feeling that I've had.
That's certainly one impression to get. I mean, and that's why we're all humans, is we do form our opinions and we do make judgments of people's actions and we're not intended to be blindly led along, and so I think that's a perfectly healthy reaction is what I'm trying to say, and I think so much hinges on how this draft turns out. If the Jazz stay at 6-12 after the lottery and don't really get impact players, it's going to be harder for people to realize the value of that trade. Now, the other part that plays into it is I think a lot of the perception of that trade has to do with whether New Jersey is able to re-sign Williams.
Absolutely.
If he ends up going to, say, Dallas as a free agent, then in a lot of ways that justifies the Jazz's paranoia about being able to re-sign him. Whereas if New Jersey is able to keep him, people around here will say, well, geez, why couldn't the Jazz have done the same thing?
Yeah, exactly. And I really think that the play of Gordon Hayward especially, and then also Derek Favors down the stretch, those last couple games, if they don't play like that those last three games, I think this offseason is very, very different. Mm-hmm. I think they bought a lot of patience by giving that little spark of excitement those last three games.
Which is a great observation, and it's so to me it's a great commentary on how willing the fans are.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
I felt that same way. I thought, here I go again. I just got pulled right back in, and all it took was, you know, an exciting play by teams that are mailing it in before the playoffs. we're so forgiving, and I'd like to be. But, you know, the criticism that comes when you have a conversation like this is people say, well, what do you want? Do you want to run the team out of town? And we had this conversation a little bit last week on this podcast that whenever I – you know, talk about the Flash, a lot of people are still angry over the Michael Jordan thing. You and I were actually sitting by each other at that game.
Right.
And, you know, I don't want to run the team out of town because of some things they've done, and I feel like they've changed. So as a small market team, you know, and you look at what's going on in Sacramento, you know, of course we don't want to lose the team, but we also don't want to be, you know, blindly, I don't know what the word would be, just taken for a ride. You know, you're invested in a team, and I don't know, it's the problem with being a fan in a small market, I guess.
Yeah, I think you make a great point, and really probably that there is a healthy balance in there somewhere. I mean, in a lot of ways it's a compliment to the Jazz fans that they're as loyal as they are, and I made the observation that night that it was remarkable how the fans treated that last game as meaningful, and they were into it, and they responded in the fourth quarter, and in a lot of ways that was refreshing, but at the same time you don't want to be deceived by, again, the quality of the opposition that night. Denver put about six guys out there, and that's all they had available at the end, and obviously not a lot of their key guys as they were resting for the playoffs, so it's easy to fall into a trap of overvaluing Gordon Hayward based on that 34-point game. But but if it gets fans through the summer, well, maybe there's something to be said
The opiate of the masses is Gordon Hayward.
That's right.
Well, talk to me a little bit about your thoughts on Andre Kirilenko. You know, I've heard kind of the word around that he would be willing to re-sign for $1 million, and I think you've written that you think he really, if he had any kind of integrity almost, I don't think that's a word you use, that's my word, but that he would resign for the veteran minimum almost as returning the favor to such a generous contract that he, you know, I don't know that anyone would say he earned it.
No.
Really with his play.
Yeah, And I kind of went a little strong in that column and almost tried to make him feel guilty. and kind of what the premise I really started out with, and maybe could have continued more along those lines, is just the idea that wouldn't it be refreshing if this was the one guy in pro sports history who didn't seek his market value and just realized that, as he said, and we quoted him, it's not about the money. I think I have enough.
Yeah.
And I think if he really played out that sentiment and put it into practice, that the people would embrace that to a huge extent, and he would be held up as a symbol that not everything is bad about pro sports, but if indeed he pursues,
it's not about the money after you get a max contract, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And
well,
so
go ahead.
If he really tries to get as much as he can out of the next contract as well on top of that $86 million, then I think people really will sour on him.
Absolutely.
Further.
And don't you think, though, of all the guys in the league, if there's one that would be willing to really not play for the money? I know he's kind of picked up the malingerer label a little bit, but I get the feeling that he actually loves the game and would love to play. And apparently Masha's family is crazy Russian oligarch money. And he does, I mean, imagine bringing $84 million into a relationship and having that not be as much as the family you're marrying into. So
right.
Really, if there's one guy who doesn't really need the money, it's Andre Kirilenko, right?
Yeah, and that's the point I wanted to make in that column as well, is that's why we all loved Andre and to begin with, is we thought he was different. If we ever used the word naive about him, it was a compliment, and that he was refreshing in so many ways, in some of the little colloquialisms he would say in his Russian/English, and the exciting dynamic way he would play, and he just seemed to be different. And so to extend this conversation, then if he really didn't act like a normal pro athlete in a contract situation, that would endear him even more to us, I think.
So what's your prediction?
My prediction is probably somewhere in the middle of
$5 million.
What we're talking about. It'll be interesting. I guess the one thing, the huge variable in all this is New Jersey and the Russian billionaire owner of the Nets and what he might be willing to spend just to get the most famous Russian basketball player in the world on his team. That could skew everything. So until we see what Prokhorov and the Nets have in mind, it really is hard to make a prediction. But I think in his heart, Andre would really like to stay here and not ask for a whole lot of money to do so.
Yeah. You know, I saw Kirilenko in the tunnel after, it was the last game because it was the Nuggets. And Timofey Mozgov.
I don't remember.
They were talking, you know, the Russian center that came from the Knicks and plays for the Nuggets. And that is a large human being. I mean, if you can make Andre Kirilenko look small, you are a large human being. What's in the water? Is that a Chernobyl thing? What's going on over there in Russia?
Interesting.
And then Masha comes up to about their waist.
That would have been fun to see.
Yeah. So what about some of the other players? Do you think Fisenko has a future with the Jazz?
You know, I've always been fond of him just because he's a funny guy. And I always remember that first summer when he was here and he had all those one-liners that made him fun to write about. But I've been disappointed in his development. And so to say he has a real future, I would question that. I mean, just like you say, how many 7-foot, 300-pound guys are there in the world that can have any skills at all? He's obviously one of those rare people, but I think by now we all expected a lot more from him, it wouldn't hurt me if he didn't come back. Let's put it that way.
Right.
Speaking of the players on the team. I mean, we've talked a lot about Al Jefferson here. Where do you place him? I mean, do you look at him as a foundation for the future? We've had a lot of debate about Al and where he really fits on this team, or if he is a good fit.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think the answer is he is a fixture, but I say that reluctantly.
Uh-huh.
He's a fixture based on how much they have invested in him, and how much they owe him on the contract they inherited, and the fact that he's the closest thing to an all-star player that they have right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so based on that, they need him. But I just don't like the way – I just don't like his game as it translates to the Jazz offense as we've come to know it.
Mm-hmm.
Just pounding the ball into the floor and backing in. This isn't the traditional Jazz way of doing things. And so I don't see it as a great fit in a lot of ways, but I also wonder what choice they have at this point.
Yeah, and do you see him and Millsap being able to be harmonious in the long term, or do you kind of have to pick one or the other?
Yeah, that's a great question as well, and I do think they can play reasonably well together. Now, Jefferson isn't a true center, and Millsap can't really be a small forward, so you're hamstrung that way in a lot of ways. But the one thing that did sort of impress me was the way they were able to pass the ball to one another at times this year, and so that kind of surprised me. That was a pleasant development. So in that sense, I think they can coexist. But ultimately, I see where you're getting at that each's basic position is power forward, and
mm-hmm.
you're only allowed to have one of those at a time, basically. So
and then you've got Derek Favors developing as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. The one thing that does make it sort of possible is that if Mehmet Okur is your center, he's not a traditional center in any sense, and so if he's basically playing outside, you can have those two guys inside. That part works for me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it'll be really nice when they have Wes Matthews. Oh, wait, they don't. So talk to me a little bit about, you know, you had a column all ready to go about Wes Matthews saying, you know, you didn't want him back, or it was the Jazz made the right decision. Then the Al Jefferson trade happened. Your column didn't run, and so history doesn't show that you were against the Wes Matthews trade. How do you, looking back on that a little bit, talk to us about your thoughts on Wes Matthews now?
Yeah, it's interesting how that's all evolved, and certainly it's kind of a two-part discussion, and the first part being whether the Jazz tried as hard as they could have to sign him even before he came back with that offer sheet. And so without knowing exactly what took place, it was kind of one of those situations where each side tells a different story. That's one argument that the Jazz failed even before Portland got involved. But once Portland did get involved, I mean, you look at it at the time, and maybe it's because we're biased about the draft and because, you know, the NFL kind of goes through this same situation that if a guy's a first-round draft choice, you tend to think he's worth more than a guy who was, say, an undrafted free agent.
Right.
Whereas what we really should be basing on is how they've produced once they got into the league.
Right.
And I think I was probably guilty of that with Matthews. I mean, I never truly valued him, even last year when he was doing a lot of good things for the Jazz, knowing what his starting point was, when in reality I probably should have given him extra credit for coming as far as he did in 1 year. But what I really thought was when Portland signed him to that offer sheet, I didn't understand why they were doing it, other than I thought their logic was just to make the Jazz match the offer and spend a lot of money, kind of like they had to do with Millsap the year before,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. So so kind of my argument was, well, make Portland be the ones that tie up all this money in a guy that's not going to be really that important to them. And clearly, I underestimated what Matthews could do in his second season. I mean, to be the Blazers' number two scorer, to play all 82 games, and to be as important as he is to that team with Brandon Roy missing about half the season. It's really been a remarkable story. So I can only say in my defense that I can't be the only one who didn't see that coming.
Absolutely not.
Well, I think that there were a lot of things. I don't think anybody has found out the real story. Were they trying to hamstring the Jazz, or did they really see that kind of talent? I've heard a rumor that they were actually trying to assemble contracts that would match up in a package and try to get Chris Paul.
I heard that as well.
And I don't know if there's any truth to that, but nobody could have known. But you're right, that's very true that we think, oh, he's an undrafted guy. And I think we all fell into the trap too that he was only getting these opportunities because of injuries. But how many times does a guy have to come in and produce before we finally say this guy can play? The same thing, I mean, that happened this year. If Brandon Roy doesn't get hurt, maybe he sits on the end of the bench and we never get to see him shine. But, you know, at some point, it's no accident that opportunities keep coming his way and he keeps coming up big. But, man, I miss him a lot.
And speaking of Wes Matthews.
Yeah, there's no question.
Yeah. Speaking of Wes Matthews, looking at the playoffs right now, Spencer and I have talked a lot about this. You've got Wes Matthews in Portland. You've got, to a lesser extent, Eric Maynor in Oklahoma City. You've got the entire Chicago Bulls roster practically.
Even DeSean Stevenson.
Yeah.
And Costa.
You want to go all, yeah, Costa. But you've got all these former Jazz guys that are out and producing and coming up big for teams in the playoffs now. And we kind of touched upon this earlier, but where, looking back, I mean, where did everything go wrong for the Jazz? That's something we've tried to, and I don't know if you could pinpoint it down on one thing. You know, Andre's contract didn't help, but at one point, can you pin it on, say, you know, this was mismanaged or this was completely out of the Jazz's hands? It's just bad pieces kind of fell in their laps.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a good subject and for conversation. And again, I can answer it by telling you what the starting point of the demise was, and we can kind of dissect it from there. And again, it's to go back to, as I referenced earlier, that the end of the 08 season when the Jazz, even though they lost in the second round to the Lakers, they were highly competitive in that series. They won the games 3 and 4 at home. Very easily could have won game 5 in Los Angeles and then had 2 3-point attempts to tie the game at the end of game 6. So when you break it down from that point, what did go wrong? And I think the Kirilenko contract has to play into that discussion, and the fact that Boozer had injuries the next year kind of soured everybody on him, and then at that same time is when the whole salary cap and luxury tax and payroll situation kind of came to a head, having to re-sign Millsap the following summer, and all those financial things I think kind of converged in a bad way, and so I think that if there would be a blanket answer, it would just be that it became fiscally impossible to keep that team together, and had they been able to do so, they really might have become something. Now, does every team go through that to a certain extent? Yes. And so the obvious answer is that it could have been managed a little bit better, but also in saying that, I think it was kind of just an inevitable demise that it's so hard to keep it team together in this salary cap era.
Now, I think everyone has had their opinion on the Jerry Sloan situation. As the season's gone on, I've kind of gone back and forth on, was he pushed out? How much was it Darren's fault? How much was it Kevin O'Connor? How much was it just he was tired and he had told the team early in the season? And I want to hear kind of after the dust has settled, we've had a couple months to think about it, what happened?
Yeah, and I admit that I have less knowledge than anybody in a lot of ways, I feel like, on this situation. But I do subscribe to the Gordon Monson theory that whatever happened with Darren and the response or failure to respond by Greg Miller and Kevin O'Connor in backing Sloan, who wanted to discipline Williams and wasn't allowed to. I really believe that theory makes a lot of sense. I can't claim to have come up with it myself, but I'm pretty close to subscribing to that. The one thing I would wonder, though, is it just seemed like things were falling apart already. Now, would the Jazz have done better than 8-20 down the stretch if Sloan were still there? Probably so. But they finished 7 games out of the last playoff spot. So that means they would have had to go 15-13 in those last 28 games to even tie Memphis and New Orleans. And I don't think Sloan could have done that. So maybe I'm steering the question in my own mind a little bit and answering it in a different way but I don't blame the whole collapse of the season on Sloan's departure. But yeah, to answer your question, which is what you were hoping I would do, I do believe that without question that the incident that happened that night, February 9th, and losing to the Bulls, is what made everything happen. I don't think it was merely a tipping point or a last straw or whatever expression you want to use. I really do believe that the events of that night put everything into play.
Wow, interesting. I heard a story that the team psychologist gave a lecture in a program at the U soon after it happened and said that Jerry had talked about stepping down at the very beginning of the season. The team had talked him back into it, and that even before the Sacramento game, a week or two before the Bulls game, he was going to, and then he decided to stick around. Do you think that's a little bit of spin, or do you think this was kind of in the works this season? Or
yeah, that's an interesting one. In my mind, I just picture Sloan. I mean, we all went through the yearly drama, so to speak, about whether he was really going to come back or not for the following season. But once he did start a season, I found it hard to believe that he wouldn't finish it out.
Right.
So I think something pretty drastic had to happen to make him leave in February.
You're right. I think that's an important piece. Because otherwise, how do you reconcile the emotion that Karl Malone showed when he showed up? Clearly he was privy to a little conversation. He doesn't have the same filter that a lot of people have. And so I think something was shared with him in confidence that kind of made him feel like a wrong had been done. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, there was some cryptic communication with Carl 2 weeks later when Darren Williams was traded, and he gave someone a message, something to the effect of, "See what I mean?"
I hadn't heard that.
Implying that the Jazz traded Williams as in something of a vindictive move. Now, whether that's true or not, we'll never know. But at least the indication that Carl was giving to some people was that the two moves definitely were connected.
Yeah. I kind of got the impression that after it happened, you know, they couldn't get Sloan to come back, but then they realized we have a culture problem on our hands where we're in danger of the kind of the number one tenet of this team is the inmates don't run the asylum. And I felt like there were some things that were put into play to reestablish the fact, I mean, signing Ty Corbin for 3 years, you know, doing some of these things that establish around here, the coach stays, you do what the coach says, and everybody else is expendable. Maybe
yeah,
that's part of it.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. And I always remember Kyle Korver saying those exact words after his first half season with the Jazz. That he marveled about how this culture was different, and it was the one place where the coach was in charge and everybody knew it, unlike the rest of the NBA. And so I totally agree with what you're saying, that I think the management and ownership of the Jazz did feel they had to make that kind of statement, and they made it.
Hmm. Well, what's one thing that we don't know about the Jazz, your favorite secret behind-the-scenes story that you've never shared in any column or on any other show?
Wow. Well, I mean, every story I have is kind of goes back to the old days when I was covering for the Deseret News, and it was the first 5 years of Malone's career, actually. And so, A, that shows how old I am, and B, those are become harder and harder for me to remember 25 years ago now. But I guess the one story that it always resonates with me is how I got locked in Reunion Arena in Dallas and had to call the police and have them come and rescue me.
You stayed too late, or what happened?
I somehow went through the wrong doors. I came back up through the stands, not knowing what the lower level exit was. And I somehow got caught in between two sets of doors, in a kind of, in essence, a lobby area. And
Roy Tarpley couldn't come get you out?
if only I'd have thought of that. For whatever reason, there was, now this is in the pre-cell phone era.
That's right.
Keep in mind, I don't think anyone had even thought of those by then. But luckily, there was a payphone there in the lobby, and I literally called the police.
That's okay.
And the hotel was like a half a block away, but I got a triumphant ride in the police car back to the Hyatt Regency.
You know, when Jerry Sloan and Phil Johnson were retiring, I asked them a question about, has the game changed? I kind of wanted to get their sense of, you know, I think the narrative that everybody wants to push on them is that today's players are petulant and whatever, and they just didn't want to deal with it. But they both responded very differently, and they weren't even sitting, you know, they weren't next to each other when I asked the question to each of them. But they basically said, the players are pretty much the same. They've always been the same since they were playing, since they started coaching. It's just the media attention brings things to light that weren't ever shown. How has it changed for you covering the team, kind of your access to players? I know back in the day it was a lot more common for the reporters to, you know, have dinner with the players, or kind of more of a, there was more off the record time than there is now. Have you, tell us a little bit about that change, if any, and if you miss the good old days.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do think it's all changed dramatically. I think the thing that's always the most striking to me is the volume of media, just simply the number of people that are around on a daily basis. And I'll give you my best example of that is that when I started covering was in the Frank Layden era, and you know what the post-game scene is like now, where the coach comes out to the podium and he's surrounded by like 25 people and answers about six questions, and that's that. And the numbers of media were so low in my day that Frank would sit in his office in the Salt Palace after a game, and if we came in one by one and asked the same questions as the previous person did, he had no problem with that.
Wow.
I mean, you just can't conceive of that.
Yeah, no, that would not happen.
Yeah, so that's the best example. The other is it all, it there's pros and cons to it, but if there ever were these formal access periods, like from, what is it, 5:30 to 6:15, the locker room is open before a game. I never even was aware of such things. I mean, I'd go in the locker room at 5 o'clock when the team bus came on the road, and I do remember a couple of times players looking at me and glancing at the clock as if to give me a message. But I remember being in there like 10 minutes before game time sometimes. So that's another striking example. And then, but you're right also in the sense of just less formal relationships. And the number one thing is that there basically weren't charter flights in those days. And so we would ride the team bus, basically, and ride the same commercial flights with the players and be sitting in there with them in the airport lobby. And so, yeah, I think the whole dynamic was different. Now I clearly remember there being the same line of demarcation in a lot of ways, that you were with the team, but you definitely were not of the team. But in terms of just being around the players more for more time and less formally, it definitely was a different dynamic that way. And so there's no doubt that the whole media player fence has become more formidable over the last 25 years.
I even wonder with the way the guys use their cell phones, et cetera, if not only are they becoming distant from the reporters, but distant from their teammates. They get on the bus, you know, they can be in their own world now and not have to interact with their teammates. So I think that changes the dynamic. I even noticed, even by the end of the season, it seemed like some of the Jazz players didn't even really know each other, you know, that I couldn't imagine them, a few of them, even ever going out and doing anything socially, grabbing a bite to eat. Is that maybe stretching it too far?
No, I think there's something to that. And I think, you know, we see less of the behind-the-scenes things. You know, we literally don't see them on the team plane to know what the interaction is like. But I do think the whole travel dynamic has changed to where it does kind of reduce the interaction. I mean, it's as simple as this, that in the old days, teams would stay overnight after a road game, and so the players would be going out in search of places to eat and whatever else.
That's a good euphemism after, right there.
Thank you. I've learned to filter some things. but the point being that there was more socializing done in the city where they just got done playing, and so they would tend to congregate in groups of three or four or whatever, whereas now they just all herd themselves onto the plane and either move on to the next city or come home, and so that dynamic's changed. I suppose an argument can be made that there's less cliquishness or segregation, if that's the right word, based on the fact that they all are sticking together in the travel scenario. But I do think a lot of relationships were formed over those dinners that they would have on the road, and that's kind of been taken away.
Yeah. There's no denying the professionalization of the sport has changed a lot of things. You know, a lot of these guys really are elite athletes, and they take care of themselves in a way that probably didn't always happen before.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a pretty good subject. It would be interesting to talk to guys about that, how that's changed over the years. If you want to go to the complete extreme, from the Jerry Sloan days when the players smoked cigarettes in the locker room at halftime.
That's incredible. Did that really happen?
If it didn't, I'm going to pretend it did.
Wow.
It's plausible.
Well, that's the story of Vlade Divac, you know, like multiple cigarettes at once at halftime or something.
It's believable. Let's put it that way. And just the whole notion that in those days, and basically true in all sports, that the players would come to training camp and start to work
play
themselves
their way into
shape.
Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And now it's a totally a year-round thing. It's so competitive to get these jobs and keep them that obviously they don't have to have other jobs, which athletes historically did in the
they don't have to go work at the paper mill in the off season.
Right.
Yeah, it goes both ways.
You're absolutely right, though. That's true.
Yeah, you talk about, you know, Michael Jordan always thinks if he plays in this era, he would score 50 with the different rules, you know, but you can go back, and if the guys were playing in this era, they would also have the same access to the training and the nutrition and all that. Yeah. So it goes both ways.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Kurt, we've taken too much of your time, but you've been great. Thank you so much for coming on. And it's really been a pleasure working with you. I just want to add one little story that when I got my first press credential kind of on the sly, you were nice enough to show me where to go. I was sure they were going to throw me out at any minute. And so I've always been indebted to you showing me around and being just a true pro through and through. So I really appreciate that. That was a random summer league game. That was a Rocky Mountain Review game.
I'm proud of myself. No, that's good. I really enjoyed the discussion. These were some of the best questions I've ever fielded. So I enjoyed it.
That's a shocker.
I'm putting that on my resume for right now. Well, good. Well, we'll touch base with you again soon, and we'll look forward to seeing you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt.
Good night. We'll see you. Bye.
Okay.
Okay, we'd like to thank Kirk for coming on. That was fantastic. We'd also like to thank the UVU Digital Media Department for lending us the use of their fine studio again. And as always, Jonathan Knudsen, our producer, doing a fantastic job as well. We'll be back again next week. Thanks again for listening, everybody. Be sure to send us a line at Salt City Hoops, saltcityhoops@gmail.com. You can also hit up Justin, J.H. Jazz Hype, on Twitter.
J.H. Justin, excuse me.
That's my fault. Yeah, he's confusing us with that.
I'm an idiot, but it's okay.
And be sure to give us your comments. Next week, we'll have another guest, and we'll look forward to that. See you then.
Awesome.